As I mentioned, we read a special Haftarah for Parshat Zachor, but the Parsha, the Haftarah we usually read this week is from Isaiah. It's one of my favorite segments because it's very satiric. In a way, Jeremiah is sometimes caustic, but Isaiah is very playfully satiric this week. A lot of the Haftarah is about idol makers and the work of an idol makers. I've joked before, I don't know if they had a union, how they were organized in craftsmanships or guilds, or if it was just a personal business. But Isaiah is very scornful of them in a very playful way. He points out the lunacy of the work of an idol maker, that the idol maker typically would take a piece of wood and carve part of it and then bow down to it. But the other part of it, he would throw in the fire and use to make bread. You know, you are my God, says Isaiah. But also I'd like some food and I need to heat my house. And then they never admit to the folly of what they're doing. They don't admit that they're basically frauds. And they buy into their own lie, I think is what Isaiah is getting at. And you'll see where I'm going with this. It's circling around a statement of Charles Dickens, or actually a statement of George Orwell about Dickens that I want to get to. I'll give you a little teaser about that. Because I think between Parshat Zachor and the word Eid, witness, or hitvadah, to make known, to make oneself known, are models of seeing clearly and models of seeing through hypocrisy and not lying to ourselves, nor to the Almighty, nor to the world at large. The first model in the parsha, it was towards the end of the reading, and it's repeatedly uses the verb arach, ayin resh kaf, which what they're describing in the parasha is to flay and position and arrange the sacrificial parts over the altar. But it also has legal meanings. It's comes the same similar meaning to editing a book. It's related to the root of being a judge or an advocate. Jastrow, who writes the Dictionary of Talmud, says that it's it conceives of the idea that the law should be worked into your 248 limbs and thereby it will be preserved. And arach also is when you dedicate a person or value in terms of making gifts to the temple, exchanging the value of an item for a cash gift to the synagogue, which even to this day and age is a way to make legacy and estate giving if you'd like to learn more. But connecting it with Parshat Zachor, or Shabbat Zachor, and the ways in which we memorialize and remember wickedness, almost, I think, I didn't say it when I was reading, to our detriment, that we over-focus on injury, and we externalize the enemy, and we externalize our problems to the point, as the Haftarah did, or the Maftir reading did, of forcing ourselves almost into a victim role. They did this to us when we were weak. They should eternally be excised and massacred and crushed. There's a way, I think, that we view ourselves from the lens of victimhood and from the lens of resentment and anger that is ultimately unproductive. I was thinking a lot this week about the ways in which people claim to be logical. You know, I make decisions, Rabbi, or friends might say this to you, from a place of logic. I don't react from emotion, which to me is a very dangerous sign to hear, because what it means is they don't realize they're acting from a place of emotion. They think they're being logical, but they mostly haven't addressed their underlying feelings about, and what's triggering them in a certain situation. So denying one's irrational senses, denying one's emotional and affective components to decision-making is actually pretty toxic, I find. People who claim to be logical are just burying their feelings, because more and more studies seem to show that emotion is a fairly good guide to decision-making once done with a clear head and clear eyes and clear heart. It's what we're designed to do. evolutionarily, we have a capacity for emotion to remind us of which person in the cave has betrayed us and which of our children we need to look out for against the cougars. So I think part of the work suggested in this week's parasha is how to view both logic and emotion through the eyes of clarity, and how to attain a place of clarity, as opposed to, I think, Zachor, which is a sort of retributive and vengeful eyes. So in Parshat Vayikra, we get the introduction of many of the different sacrifices, and we're told that salt belongs on the altar, but neither leaven nor honey. And of course, honey in the ancient Near East was not bee honey, but probably date syrup. And my first thought is that preservation is okay. That's what salt can do, but not fermentation. Leaven and honey are part of fermentation and self-inflation. They're not part of containing the feelings, but letting them run rampant. And Menachem Mendel, the Hasidic Rebbe of Kotsk, I don't know if I agree with this, but he says that honey is ultra-sweet and leaven is ultra-sour. Maybe? I don't know. My wife is in the middle of a lot of biology experiments in our house making kefir and kombucha at home. I don't know if I would call yeasty things sour, but his point, even if it's a stretch, is that God doesn't like extremes. And Maimonides would say the same thing. The issue is to find sort of the clear point in the middle, neither confused by logic nor emotion, neither confused by an extreme belief or another, but a sense of self and situation that is perceptive, clear-eyed. So as I mentioned, the other verb used in this week's parasha is various iterations of the root yud dalet ayin, to know, to be alert to. A lot of the Torah reading prior to what I shared was what happens when you become alert to something you've done, when you make a wasted oath typically, when you have the ability to confess or to testify but do not, and you realize your oath. Again, using those words, hitvada, to make known to oneself effectively and to make known publicly. I mean, that's the work, I think, of all human life, is to become more self-aware. You get about however many decades or years or months or days of a life. And once calculated, the average lifespan is about 30,000 days. It's certainly never long enough to become truly self-aware, but I do think that's the work. And I'll explain to you why I think it matters in society in just a moment. And my first high holiday sermon I ever gave in any significant space was about, can you lie to God? Just occurred to me in a dream, this question of can you lie to God? And I had trouble answering it, but then I realized the answer is in this week's parasha. So in chapter 5, verse 21, I think it's the very first line I read today, when a person transgresses and commits a betrayal against God by lying to one's family. So Rashi quotes Rabbi Akiva, who said, why does the Torah consider him to have committed a betrayal against God? Rashi answers, because in defrauding one's fellow, you're also defrauding the third party to their dealings. And when I wrote this down, I put third party in capitals because the third party is God. God is the ultimate arbiter of all justice. So say some Hasidic texts, you could lie to yourself, but lying to God is really, it's just a kind of self-deception. And there are things in the Talmud we're told that even if no earthly court could condemn you, you're accountable. Presumably accountable to that third party once again. So the trial of lehitvada, yada, aid, the various roots we see in the Torah and Haftorah this week of witnessing, of declaring testimony, of testifying and being self-reflective is an ongoing work. But why does it matter today? Why does it matter in the broader society? And here George Orwell quotes Charles Dickens, revealing something I've always believed but hadn't put the words to. In some ways, my rabbinate started out as a very apolitical rabbinate. My primary theme, I think, of my work is helping people to gain wisdom for themselves, about the world around them, a truer and more clear understanding of their defenses and triggers and spirituality and the places they resist their highest self. But George Orwell, I didn't realize they were contemporaries. Apparently, early in Orwell's career, he tried to convert Dickens to communism, which is strange to think about because Orwell eventually became so opposed. But Orwell said of Dickens that he would say, "It's useless to change institutions without a change of heart." That essentially is what Charles Dickens was always telling me, says Orwell. So in this era, I think institutions are desperately in need of change. From our synagogue to NATO, we see the power of very particular people to be self-deluded. And in this, I'll point a finger clearly at Vladimir Putin. And to disrupt and to pervert and to cause institutions to deviate to extremes that are toxic for the entire of society and the whole of the world. And it would be nice, as I said in my letter about Ukraine, if more people took the Abder Rebbe's advice to learn to master themselves and to understand themselves, because then they would be taking out fewer of their narcissisms and triggers and unresolved issues on other countries and on institutions and on other board members. So we've all seen in various boards we've ever served on. I am not a fan of Dickens' writing. I've never enjoyed his novels, but I really think he captures something essential about the human existence in that statement of Orwell, that it's useless to change institutions without a change of heart. And it was very rewarding to me to realize what I've always been preaching about, the individual rather than, or at least earlier on, about the individual over the institution, because I do feel that institutions are powerless to shift unless the people within them are continually growing and searching and trying to see more clear-eyed and not be held back by their own resentments, as we seem to be as a people about Amalek and Haman. But to see clearly, to self-testify, to give witness to oneself, lehit palel, to be self-reflective. And therefore, Talmud, I'll conclude with a quote from Talmud, that the righteous are accountable if they could protest and did not. That's the linkage, I think, is from interior work and mindfulness to the broader community, is to make ourselves as whole as possible, not for any vain or self-serving reason, but so that we can serve the community, so that we can protest, whether it's little protestations or advocacy in any of its forms, that we make ourselves more holy, more clarified, more self-understood, so that we can make ourselves understood to others and advocate for the most vulnerable among us who don't have the luxury of doing that reflective work because they are refugees from other crises.